Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRue Show for Saturday, October 5th, 2013. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and our topic today of great universal interest, I'm sure, is if you want to eat, cancel Wall Street. And I'm very glad that we have three people here to discuss aspects of this today, because it's harvest time in the Northern Hemisphere, which is the biggest landmass on our planet, and we, from one of the most important farm belts in the Northern Hemisphere, we have from Minnesota, Southern Minnesota, Andy Olson on the line. Welcome, Andy.
Hi.
And farther to the west of him from southeastern South Dakota, we have Ron Wysorek on the line. Hi, Ron.
Howdy.
And it's also by telephone, but someone you'll know from LaRouche Political Action Committee's TV studios and operations. We welcome Hector Rivas. Hi, Hector.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. And it all sounds good. And I have a very simple, straight message by way of introduction of if we want to eat, we'd better cancel Wall Street, because as everyone knows who sees the headlines and who has real information, yes, we have a government shutdown. The federal government in shutdown. Congress is in Washington, D.C. They're not in their home districts. It's an impasse. But in fact, what we really have is an economic breakdown. And we have a situation where the government shutdown and also the orchestration of the crisis over the debt ceiling of the federal government of the United States, which has a mid-October deadline set on it, all of this kind of thing is part of a swindle operation being conducted under Wall Street orders for Obama and cohorts to kill Glass-Steagall. That's what's behind this government shutdown and the debt ceiling crisis orchestration. Let me say that a few hours ago, Mr. LaRouche and several people, including Hector and other staff, met, as they often do weekly, but went over the situation. And since then, a statement's been put out, which we're going to get out all over the place. Please look for it, everyone, soon on LaRouchePub.com, where you hear this show. But otherwise, you'll see it. It might already be on LaRouchePack.com. And the headline of this statement is that LaRouche says, behind the shutdown and debt ceiling swindle, Wall Street orders Obama to kill Glass-Steagall. Now, I usually don't read, but I'm going to read a few sentences because it says it like it is. The reality, as bluntly stated by Lyndon LaRouche today, is that the ongoing government shutdown and threatened default on U.S. sovereign debt on October 17 is nothing more than an orchestrated swindle aimed at conditioning the American people for the murderous policies that have already been accepted by Obama and by leading congressional Republicans. So Lynn says, and here's a quote from him in this short statement, "The moment of truth has arrived. I call on the American people to demand that Congress stop behaving like a bunch of corrupt fools going along with the Wall Street Obama swindle. Pass Glass-Steagall, wipe out the power of Wall Street and their European cohorts, allies, and get on with the business of reviving this nation and the world around a plan of genuine development, as my colleagues and I have spelled out." So there's a few particulars. I won't go into them all because we have much to hear from the Midwest, from Hector. But in the past week, a few things stand out that back up what we're talking about here. One thing happened on Wednesday, October 2nd. At the White House, Obama met with all the top mega banks of the London Wall Street axis. That would be Jamie Dimon from J.P. Morgan. He met with Deutsche Bank, Citicorp, you name it. There were a bunch of them. They're part of something called the they have a little front group called Financial Services Foundation, I think. And so that's one element of, there you have it, where there's all this flurry going on about Yosemite Park being shut down and many other worthy things, like the fact that millions, over 8 million women and children who really depend on help under the Women, Infants, and Children's Program for milk products and other things. That's discontinued this weekend. But apart from that, what stands out is this is a whole harem scarum serving the banking interests that Obama's. This is what's being put out there, that it's that the American people are supposed to be freaked and go along with accepting bail-ins of different kinds, accepting that the spigot keeps open of $85 billion a month, or at least, to these mega banks in the way of a bailout, but otherwise that the banks can lay hands on through different kinds of financial interests can lay hands on the means to existence of the city of Detroit, or of credit for farmers, or of the means to even eat by 48 million poor Americans who qualify for food stamps. So this is the, it's not just a government shutdown. In other words, it's that you're supposed to be shut down. Individuals' lives are supposed to be shut down in this. It's a load of crap, and we want to get this statement out everywhere and get this concept out everywhere. As Lynn also said, the government shutdown's the biggest dog and pony show ever, intended to prepare the population to accept more hyperinflation, more bailouts and bail-ins, and worsening conditions so that Wall Street can survive just a little bit longer while honest, hardworking Americans die in ever greater numbers. Now, so that's the situation. And, you know, we've all, as of many weeks ago, when Obama announced he was going to bomb Syria, and Americans had a gut sense, it's almost like in our DNA, and if not our personal experience, that we've had it. People had a sixth sense, no more war, no more Afghanistan, no more Iraq, no on a hit on Syria, just cancel it. And really the grounds for the sixth sense reaction now in our DNA is we're not going to shut down the means of existence. Not our family, not your family, not our nation. We're going to have food, we're going to have problems, but we're going to lay the basis for the right emergency measures and the right long-term measures. That's what we want to have. So it's from that vantage point, pointing out that statement I just said, and from this sense of things, that this is it, that I want to turn to, first let's get our farm state members' response, or guests today, to the fact that if you go back to when Glass-Steagall was repealed in 1999, and you know, within 2 years of that, you had electricity deregulation. That was the great Enron era for a while there until it crashed in 2001. You had in 2000 a terrible follow-up to the Glass-Steagall repeal passed called the Commodities Futures Modernization Act, which was like the gambling act for commodities, food, bacon, you name it. And then September 11th in 2001, we had this emergency assault, orchestrated assault by Saudi Anglo enemies of mankind on the United States. And in the last 10 to 13 years, we've seen tremendous hyperinflation that everybody experiences, although many people don't. It's like, you know, it's all around you, but people aren't always putting it together. So there was a statement put out, Hector was part of the team, that says Wall Street is killing you with hyperinflation. And the first graph here is taking food prices, bread, beef, fruit, apples, and it's all gone way up since year 1999 to year 2012. Things have gone up in price by 50%, 80%. For sure, the cost of eating every year has risen. Same with electricity, same with heating oil, same with essentials, rent or housing payments. And you're out there both planning to eat like other citizens, Ron and and Andy, but you all see this from a special point of view too, that what's happened in just this time frame, although you can go back longer. Why don't you comment on what's any aspect of what's involved in this food retail price rise? Either one of you first.
Well, to support what you said there, the price hikes in food, the value of the food, U.S. food that it was exported in dollar values increased 96% from 2004. But when you look at it from the physical economic standpoint of the volume of food, it only increased 9%.
Huh, so there's real hyperinflation for
Yeah.
you. Uh-huh. And the other thing is, do you want to throw in here? I know, Andy, you've been saying the farm sector itself, look at the, do you want to say something about the prices you have to pay for the inputs to be able to produce a crop?
Yes, I think what I would add here is that we had Glass-Steagall in 1999, but I believe it was 2001 when the Agriculture Department had authority over the commodity futures.
Uh-huh.
And the Sheila Barr, I think, was the one that was the head of the commodity futures board then. And there was this move to deregulate the commodity futures trading, and it was called the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. And my representative, Colin Peterson, is today the minority leader of the House Agriculture Committee, and he said this year, in March 20th, he said, the two worst votes that I ever made in Congress, one was to deregulate Glass-Steagall, and the second was to vote in favor of the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which allowed for the derivatives to enter into the commodity markets unregulated. And as of that time period and a number of years after, we had between 4,500 and 5,000 hedge funds on Wall Street and all around the country. And these, they're parasites, hedge funds. They're just, they'll take over a business or a trading floor, and some of these exchanges, Kansas City and Minneapolis and so forth, they don't have the independence they used to have. But going back to 1972, I had just gotten out of the Army in Vietnam, and I was with my father at the local grain elevator, and I was standing there, and this other farmer hollered and said, what's the price doing in Chicago? And I didn't really know what he was talking about, because I hadn't been involved with agriculture for about 6-7 years.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know what it was, but this was the beginning of the Chicago Board of Trade having influence on our prices.
Mm-hmm.
So, say the price of corn would vary only about 5-6 cents a year. There was no fluctuation. But following that, in 19, I think it was the Russian grain robbery, they came in and speculated and bought up all the paper of the feed grains, and they owned them, and the markets went through the roof, you might say, and this started the speculation in agriculture.
73, 74. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was going to say 74.
74, but, uh-huh.
And since then, and it really accelerated from 2001 on, where the speculation has an immediate or a put-through impact on the consumer food prices. And it's like the hedge funds are siphoning money off of this food pipeline, and the farmers have been forced to deal with this, and it really is psychologically difficult for them to try to figure out what the speculation is, because you can't. they decide where the market's going to go with.
Right. I hope we didn't lose the connection there. We'll have to call back if the cell phone. But what? Oh, here we'll check again. But psychologically, was it, farmers have been put in the position of having to bet on what?
Here, somehow I got cut off.
Yeah, I was just going to say you just when you were saying psychologically, farmers have been put in this rotten position of almost having to bet on what they think's happened, when they should sell, when they should buy inputs, right?
Yes.
Go ahead.
And
you're clear.
It has cost the farmers a lot of money, and the consumers more. And the only way that we're going to solve this is with Glass-Steagall. I can't see any other way. There's horrific speculation right now. The price of corn from a year ago has dropped by over $3 a bushel, and I don't think we warrant that kind of a drop with what we have produced this year. But that's what we have to live with.
Yeah. And why don't you spell that out a little for people to know? Whereas a year ago, it might have been seven something, Andy.
Yes, about $7.50 for a bushel of corn, and today it's about $4.25, and that's a huge cut into farmers' gross income. And you know, farmers are saying, well, we're going to store the grain and it might go up, and who knows what's going to happen here. I mean, there's so much uncertainty. Back in the early 70s, when I talked about the Chicago Board of Trade starting to have an influence,
yes,
we had reserves. We had commodity reserves that the Department of Agriculture would support the farmer to store this grain, and we would have at least a year's reserve. But now there's no reserves. We're like just-in-time manufacturing on the farm.
And, of course, it's not in time for some people, since people should visualize corn. I think Andy's on the phone today because it's raining and he can't be harvesting it. But in early September, apparently the Agriculture Department's estimate was that we had maybe the lowest level of corn from last year's harvest and around anywhere in 16 or 20 years. And they lie. They overstate it. And the biggest corn state in the country, Iowa, was sucking in corn from other states because they didn't have it there. That takes us into biofuels. But it's just what you're saying, Andy, right?
Another aspect of it the input costs this spring were up 17% from the year before, with the added price of fuel and fertilizers and their other inputs. And actually, 7 out of the last 11 years, we've used up more food than we've produced. So we are eating up our surplus and our reserve. We have the lowest food reserve right now since 1974.
Mm-hmm.
And the prices have gone down dramatically.
Yeah, you were saying about the corn is about half of what it was. So, what's this setting the farmers up for is another, commodity collapse along with inflation on their inputs.
Right.
Yeah,
go ahead.
It's psychologically difficult for farmers to absorb all this. You put a young fella in there that he's just getting started farming, and his father or his uncle or whatever has been dealing with this, and he's faced with this. He's got to be a tremendous manager and mechanic to fix the equipment, and it's a big challenge.
Right, and maybe one of you want to say, too, that even the lousy, rotten Agriculture Department statistics show that when it comes to average farm income of a family farm operation, you are completely reliant on off-farm income. Where it, I looked up the statistics. I have them right here. And in year 2000, maybe the average family farm income from farming, from actual farming, was about $2,000. Now they say, because of the last few years, it might be near $15,000. But, of course, you don't live or operate on that. It depends on working off the farm, right?
Yes, and so the wife a lot of times has to work. And sometimes the farmer has seasonal employment to keep things going. But the last few years, because of the green energy and the biofuels, there's been a, that's why we had $7.50 corn a year ago. And, you know, 40% of the corn is being eaten up by the ethanol plants around, and this to me is just it to be burning our food is immoral, and the farmers like it because generally they like it because it increases the prices. They don't think about the larger damage that it's doing to the food security of the nation.
Well,
It's interesting here in South Dakota. You know, we've got a state-of-the-art packing plant that was open for about 2 months here this spring, and then it was shut down, and now it's in bankruptcy. But we've got all kinds of money to keep these ethanol plants going that would all be bankrupt if it wasn't for the government subsidies on them. We have all kinds of money here within the state, hundreds of millions of dollars, to build gambling casinos and auditoriums, but we haven't got the money to, and we can't help a state-of-the-art packing plant, which is absolutely needed for the processing of beef in the country. To me, it just shows the sense of morality that is persistent in the country along this path of not understanding physical economics any longer.
Right, and I'm sure you... both of you have been in state capitals and your neighbors and every Middlesex village and farm, isn't that the expression, over the need for Glass-Steagall. And, of course, what goes along with that is many farmers, it's like being subliminally discouraged. Figure you could never have a parity price situation. Could you address that? Because they're due to depressed, cowardly, or beaten down to figure that you could get a decent price unless you have something immoral like ethanol driving up the price of corn. Could you address that?
Well,
yeah.
Go ahead, Andy.
Okay.
I would say that it would be difficult to try to implement parity pricing without Glass-Steagall. Glass-Steagall would change the whole dynamics out here, and we would have to have some really good thinkers to figure out how to, because you can't back things up very quickly without disrupting everything as far as the supply of inputs, which are all controlled by the cartels. This packing plant is an example. Most of the cartels are into the meat processing, and this new packing plant in Aberdeen, they probably weren't authorized to join the club. So they've struggled, and it's unfortunate. But a lot of people invested in something like that. So back to the parity price, it's been traditional, and that's rearing its head now in the farm bill, because if they don't have a farm bill by the 1st of January, then milk prices will... that's what the media is looking at, like, oh, they could quadruple and so forth, and the farmers would get a windfall. Well, that's a really a lame formulation. But the farm bill is being held hostage by this shutdown talk and everything. And my, again, Colin Peterson, my congressman, he's in one of the leaders of the farm bill, and he is adamant that If we tie the farm bill to broader budget talks, then the congressional leadership you know, if we want Boehner in there and some of these others deciding what the farm bill decision should be, then this would not be a good situation for agriculture in. And it may be the end of the farm bill.
Well, I think we have to look at it from the standpoint of what Lynn talks about, by the total of a total system meltdown. And yeah, we have to get rid of Wall Street. Has to go. The first thing has to be done is Glass-Steagall put on the books. The Commodity Board of Trade has to go, and then also that what has to go with this bad system that we're into is the World Trade Organization and NAFTA. I mean, it was in the mid-1990s when supporters of the World Trade shoved the idea down our throat that they were going to get us higher prices by increasing our exports with NAFTA and the World Trade Agreement. But U.S. food or exports have increased, but so has food imports. And in 2012, the total volume of U.S. food exports stood at only 1% higher than they were in 1995, the year that the World Trade Organization took effect. In contrast, imports of food to the United States in 2012 had skyrocketed 97% from 1995. I mean, the lies that they've been feeding the American people, just like with the Wall Street bailout, they're absolutely essential for the well-being of the economy. I mean, all they're doing is destroying the physical economy, and the whole system is melted down. So if we don't approach it from getting rid of Wall Street and getting us back to a parity system, this country isn't going to make it. Another thing, in 2012, the volume of U.S. food exports, again, like I said, was only 1% higher than in 1995. And that was the year that, the World Trade Agreement took effect. And in contrast, U.S. imports in 2012 were 97% higher than in 1995. I mean, those figures alone there ought to, if they were put out to the farmers and backed up with the facts. And another thing that happened from that was the demise of the family farmers from 1995 to the current day of losing about 170 some thousand more small farms in the United States that were actually would decrease our numbers by 21% of farmers, where the specialty food producers of vegetables and fruits that are now being produced in Canada and especially the United States and South America, where we are now running a food trade deficit with those countries. And definitely has to be, come to an end. At the same time that NAFTA went into effect, killing 2 million farmers or putting 2 million farmers out of business in Mexico, and many of those migrating to the United States now, creating another Band-Aid issue with immigration. Until we address the whole subject of agriculture and manufacturing from the standpoint that LaRouche's talking about, we're not going to go anywhere because this system is absolutely done. I mean, we need a new system. We've got to get back to Abraham Lincoln's, little short speech about I'm for tariffs and duties and I'm for state-created credits and I'm for infrastructure development. Another thing I was just looking at here, talking about, moving our economic ties to Asia, was in 1950, when you looked at the 10 largest cities, five of them were in the U.S. and Europe. In 2013, only two of them are in Europe and the U.S., New York and London, and there's seven of them in the Asian nations now. So, I mean, that definitely signifies that we are moving towards an urban society, and agriculture production is going to become more and more important. We've got the real crisis is in food production and physical economics, and I think that's what's stressed with getting us back to, Glass-Steagall law as the beginning of turning the system back to sanity.
Right. Go ahead.
Something to add to that is all these things that Ron just discussed have put a tremendous amount of pressure on the whole production in the system. And any kind of weather disruptions can have a big effect. It, you saw the floods in Colorado, and the infrastructure wasn't up to it and just disrupted, and will take years and billions to rebuild. And what just happened recently in Mexico with the collision of two hurricanes, Ingrid and Manuel, the agriculture in Mexico has just been brought to its knees by all this tremendous flooding and damage. And how is it going to get rebuilt? And in this type of financial environment, the only thing we can really count on is population reduction, because the will to rebuild and to do better is so hamstrung by this speculation and Wall Street and hedge funds and so forth. It's difficult, despite the heroic efforts of farmers and so forth to produce the food, that we do need a new system here, and that's Glass-Steagall. That's, you know, we can talk about a lot of things, but if we don't get Glass-Steagall, we have to get this pretty quick. I just feel like it's things, you know, this shutdown is, you know, when you opened the show, Marcia, and talked about Wall Street using this shutdown to eliminate Glass-Steagall, we can't let that happen. We all have to collaborate out here and cooperate with each other and do the best we can to get this Glass-Steagall implemented and reintroduced.
Another thing, Andy, you know, we were talking about the collapse of the corn production. One of the reasons for the collapse of the corn production is the lie that we've got this giant crop out here, especially this giant corn crop. But we haven't got it in the bin yet. And with what's happened to the west of us here with 50 inches of snowfall in the Black Hills and the West River area here having a corn crop that looked almost as good as what's in Iowa, I mean, there's has to be a lot of eardroppage out there with the 70-mile-an-hour winds and the heavy ice coating on those Milo heads and also on the corn ears. So, I mean, we're rapidly losing what these guys were hammering us over the head with to lower our corn prices. Another interesting figure is that 20% of all the corn produced in the world is produced in the United States of America here. 15% of the world corn crop is used for ethanol. And then when you consider that 40% of last year's crop went to ethanol production alone in the United States, I mean, this insanity is a deliberate intent to short people of food. The other thing is Mexico, prior to NAFTA, used to produce enough corn to feed itself and actually export corn. Today, it's importing six times the corn that was imported or even actually imported into Mexico during the prior 5 years before NAFTA went into effect. So you can see the distortions that are created by this insane free trade market, where the only thing is moving the food to where you can make the most profit. Doesn't matter how much of the energy you waste in moving the food, because in the long run you're driving up the demand for fuels by moving this insanity around. But it lets it the food movement be handled by a very few people in the world, and that's one of the real dispersions or misnomers that should be straightened around is on the disparate the placement of food around the world.
Right, the long haul food system, right?
Right.
It's controlled by very few. It's like Walmartization,
right.
Cargill, Bungie, Louis Dreyfus, and so forth.
And then if we want to look at it from the standpoint of Glass-Steagall, and then implementing NWAPA immediately to get people back to work, so we can very efficiently move this corn crop to the hungry people of the world, rather than buying the food out of the starving people's mouth, because it's more efficient or dollar wise to buy it out of the mouths of starving people than produce it ourselves. I mean, this is insanity. Immoral insanity is the only way I can describe it.
Yeah, it's very graphic. If people, you know, probably over 80%, for example, of all the certain kinds of things, as you mentioned, specialty vegetables or fruits, like frozen broccoli in the United States, maybe 80% of it comes from Mexico, while Mexico's in terrible drought and had these hurricane impacts. And this is taking food away. This is starving people on our continent.
Marcia, we have politicians like our representative from South Dakota here that is dancing up and down trying to get $40 billion cut out of the food stamp program. I mean, that's that money that is, you know, that comes from those food stamp program ends up in the producer's pocket and the processor's pocket and the distributor's pocket. The poor people are not getting advantage of it. At least they're creating some business where we're generating some taxes. Where this representative of mine has supported has supported Wall Street to the tilt, and we haven't got one benefit back from them.
Right. Christy Noem is her name. I know she's famous here in Washington for having authored such a thing to take $4 billion, just to say there's too many eaters on the getting food relief in the U.S., 48 million. So we should.
Well, I didn't say her name because I can't say her name without swearing.
Oh, okay. Well, you'll keep good. Now, I wanted to see, is Hector still with us on the question of this money system? I know you've been giving it a lot of thought that people just figure, when they think food, they certainly don't think farming for most of Americans. Is that, do we have you, Hector?
Yes, I'm on. And I'd like to pose what I have as a question more than as a comment.
Okay, good.
Now, this can go towards anybody. I think the parameters of what I think would come about as an answer have been covered. You know, the mention of the WTO, the Chicago Board of Trade, et cetera, were mentioned.
Right.
But I'd like to just bring up the issue of the process, so that I just make sure that people do understand what this is and how, you know, shutting down the Wall Street community would be essential to getting not just fair pricing, but a completely different concept of economics on the table, which is the only thing that's going to work and save us from the debacle that's going on in D.C. and affecting us nationwide. Now, yes, 2 weeks ago, there was a document that was initiated by Lynn on the issue of the inflation. And, you know, on a very quick glance, just a few hours, there some things that should have just been obvious, you know, were presented even to us. Now, I'll just mention here, just to put a face to this, you know, I think, I'm not too sure if most people remember, but at least I do, that, you know, during the presidential debates between Obama and Mitt Romney, particularly the town hall event, there was an African-American citizen who stood up and asked Barack Obama point blank, what are you going to do about the economy? Things have gotten really expensive. And you can see the stress in this man about, you know, the tightening of the belt to survive daily. Now, coming back to then being conscious of what has been the process of the direction of hyperinflation, you know, Mr. LaRouche directed that we look at the 2001 period as the ignition point, that is post 9/11 till today. Now, before me, you know, I just to give a few numbers for people, you know, looking back in 1999, which was the year of the repeal of Glass-Steagall, till 2012 as a completion year, you look at something like flour. In 1999, the average price for per pound of flour was 29 cents. As of last year, going into this year, is now 52 cents. That is an increase of about 75%. You look at something like spaghetti, macaroni, which is also a pretty, it's an average staple for most Americans, especially poor Americans. In 1999, the average household paid 88 cents per pound. And as of now, $1.32. Now, something else, which is also crucial, you look at steak, sirloin in particular. In 1999, you know, you were looking at $4.37 on average for per pound. Now it's $6.65 what people pay out of their pocket per pound. That's a 52% increase, more than half. And then bacon, you know, 1999 again, it's you're looking at $2.55 per average per pound. Today, $4.56. That is a 78% increase. Now, the figures that I gave here are strictly food. I did not mention rent, let alone sales of housing. I did not mention gasoline, which I know is a very sensitive topic for most people. I did not mention utilities, etc. But just to, you know, I just want to mention that just to widen the scope of what we're talking about, what it takes to just live. Now, this is just fact. These increases of prices from 50% to over 70% of spaghetti, macaroni, bacon, steak, I didn't mention, but also includes round roast, ground beef, etc. Right? That's just fact. That raising from 1999 to now. And what I'd like to hear a little bit more, and I know, I think Andy, I think, correct me if I got your name wrong. Excuse me. But you mentioned the Chicago question, and I'd just like to have a little bit more discussion or clarity about, well, then what is the relationship specifically of these increases of prices, which is impacting the consumer, to the way that Wall Street has been handling things up to this period or even before? If you can just say a little bit more of what is the relationship of this hyperinflation drive as it connects to this Wall Street gang in Chicago and New York, Manhattan?
Well, that's a difficult question for me to address, but I look at it as in the pipeline, there's leaks, there's siphons, and when there are run-ups, these speculators take advantage, or when there's deflation in prices, they can make money on the downside as well as the upside. And this taking this money out of the pipeline has got to be, there has to be an effect on the price of food. Now, I don't know how you can quantify that with the statistics, but usually food, it is a small margin business. Grocery stores, they don't have a big markup, but some of these hedge funds can take millions of dollars out of the market, and somebody has to pay for that. And to me, that's a big part of this inflation, is the hedge funds. And I'll use an example of gasoline or petroleum. South of us in northern Iowa has been a fuel depot off the pipeline, and it used to be Williams Brothers and so forth. And you drive by it now, and it says Magellan. And Magellan is a hedge fund. And you look at that place, the only money they've spent is to paint on the tank, cover up the name of the former owner, and now they have a sign out front that says Magellan. And you could just see that there hasn't been upgrades in the infrastructure of that terminal. And that they're parasitic, they're loose. They want to get as much money as possible, and they don't think about the future. Now, the Chicago Board of Trade, Hector, I don't know if I've, you know, addressed that the way you would like me to address it, but I know that's the den of thieves. The derivatives trading has added to this, magnified it by multiples. So it is the speculation that's doing this.
Right, and there's plenty of liquidity sloshing around. It was mentioned about the year 2000 Commodities Futures Modernization Act, where all kinds of anything goes trading was allowed, and under the same house you can have commercial banking, speculative activities, investment's a polite name for gambling in Chicago or elsewhere. And this characterizes the whole system. There's no, this isn't the exception, this is the rule. And both Ron mentioned Andy too, but you have on the food processing side, the major famous names like meat processing include Smithfield, whose okay has been given to be acquired by the Hong Kong-based Chinese processor. Smithfield's biggest, produces 24% of the hogs at least in the country and is the biggest hog slaughterer. But you have beef, you have this JBS Brazilian-based outfit. Maybe 60-80% of all the meat, beef, hogs, to the degree you have lamb or anything else, is just a few firms, but they can pay as little to producers, dairy cattle, or hog raisers as these firms want to, because if they muscle out any other independent processors, then you have nowhere to sell anything to. So it's this, but the hedge fund money has come in to all along the line. That's a polite name for the financial swindlers, including all kinds of the fruit and vegetable process stuff that's especially based in Canada coming into the U.S. You can add more, Ron, but you know it right there. You're talking about the Aberdeen plant, right?
Right. But what I'm also talking about is the plantation farmers we're creating out here.
Go
along
ahead.
With, you know, running 2 million farmers out of business in Mexico, and then those farmers come up here as slave labor on these commercial farms up here, on these bigger plantation farms. I mean, it's the same fight that Lincoln fought against when he fought against the plantation system. And back to the Board of Trade and Wall Street. I mean, it to me, it's quite simple. It's a financial institution based on speculation, usury, and gambling. I mean, we have to get back to what this country was built on, and that was productivity, the ingenuity of people, the imagination of people to think to the future, and that imagination was funded with credit so we could accomplish things and come up with new ideas and new methods of thinking and make those two things we got on the end of our arms more efficient when it comes to production and housing and clothing, more and more people at a higher and higher standard of living. I mean, when we look at money as value, we've lost everything. We need to burn every economics 101 book in this country. Another thing is absolutely essential is parity. It doesn't matter what the price of stuff is, as long as you got a parity. If you've got $1.25 an hour, you know, minimum wage like we had in 1968, to have a comparable buying power today, you'd have to have a minimum wage of $21.50 an hour. So if you get things set up with a scientific method of parity and give it some leeway, like a 10 or 15 or 20% leeway, where you can have a little fluctuation, but the insanity of what's going on today, where you can make more money in a 2 minute bet on Wall Street than you can with a 50 year investment in a packing plant in South Dakota that's absolutely essential for feeding people, there's something wrong with that idea.
Right.
You can go to, you know, corn ethanol. It's just insane what they've done with corn ethanol. And now they've created some kind of a scheme where they're not going to be able to produce the ethanol that was mandated, so you can buy these pieces of paper, and now they're trading these pieces of paper, and they started out like, I don't know, 25 cents a point or a unit, you know, and now they're $1.50 a unit, and now they're afraid the whole damn thing is going to collapse on them. I mean, it's total insanity. There's no reason for any of this thing if you've got a human brain that has been developed with the ability to think.
Right, and just in the remaining minutes that you mentioned, if you get away from money as value, the kind of thing we could do, what we could be doing with defending against weather change, anything you may want to say about the new returning to commitment to higher energy advancement, nuclear power, whether it's crop breeding, which has to take out of the hands of Monsanto, or whether it's large-scale infrastructure projects, if you want to say something about that, Ron.
Well, if they'd followed through with Kennedy's NWAPA program of bringing water down from Alaska and Canada, which Canada was very supportive of at one time, I mean, and wanted to do it more than the United States wanted to do it. If we'd followed through with that, we probably wouldn't have this freak weather we've had. We certainly wouldn't be running out of food. I mean, there's a biblical principle that also enters into this of setting, you know, 1/7 of your land aside for a rest every year. That has gone out of the window. We're out here planting fence to fence. We're mining the soils of their minerals and their humus materials, and I mean, we're headed for destruction. We're tearing out the fence lines. We're tearing out the trees out here. If we come into a dry period here of 3 or 4 years in the northern plains, I mean, we're going to have a dust bowl worse than they had in the 30s. And it's brought on by the lack of development technology and moving with thermonuclear energy so we can use that water. You know, any drop, like Kennedy said, any drop of water that runs to the ocean without being first used is a waste. And we're certainly wasting a lot of water here. And the other thing is the way we're monocropping this system is we're plowing up our wetlands and our and I mean, there's no place for what the grass is all disappearing. The cattle are disappearing out here. I mean, it's a disaster from the standpoint if you're looking at it of feeding people in the future. I mean, we're all robbing from our grandkids in the future. We're robbing from the kids that weren't born. And with Kennedy's NWAPA project, how many kids could have been born? You know, if that project was in place, we'd have a room for another 400 or 500 million people in the southwest part of the United States and Mexico. That's the kind of agriculture we need to be talking about. High technology, not making money and coming up with another scheme to screw another farmer off the land.
Oh, Ron, yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, it is. The whole system is, from when you and I were young, I mean, we produced really a quality product and with a lot of work. And now all these machines and so forth.
Well, Andy, the quality product that we produced back then were the kids that come off the farm and the kids that come off the small, and we haven't produced that. We're the damn failures. We haven't produced that.
Ron, do you think these young people could step in now and take over and do as good a job as the generation before?
No, they can't, but that's not their fault. It's our fault, and we need to do something about it. We need to have it's like the youth movement there in the LaRouche organization. If it wasn't for those young people, I'd give up a long time ago. If it wasn't for those young people around Benjamin Franklin and it, you know, who was like 63 years old in 1776, and George Washington 43, and Thomas Paine 41, the rest of the guys are kids around 20 or younger. I mean, Lafayette and these guys, they were all Hamilton. These guys are all kids. But they changed the world, and that's what we got to have again. We've got to tap these kids on the shoulder and use the experience that you and I have and the expertise that we have to get these young people back on track. Don't tolerate the bullshit that's going on out there. It's time to call an end to it and not be afraid.
Glass-Steagall. The beginning.
Yeah. I just about created a riot here in Mount Vernon last night talking to two of my state legislators.
Yeah, do you want to tell them that? I think you had some social occasion that turned into a real focus, right? It was the homecoming or something?
Yeah, I was a homecoming king 53 years ago, so I had to walk. We got flooded out here, so we walked through the auditorium. But here's these two politicians that I've been after to sign a letter to Tim Johnson calling for the immediate hearings of Glass-Steagall in the Senate Banking Commission. And they've been giving me BS about why they can't sign it, you know. So I caught him right there in the hallway in front of about, the hallway probably had 100 or 200 people in it. And I just, with my Glass-Steagall cap on, I just walked right up to both of them and asked them why they hadn't signed the letter. And they started giving me BS about, you know, Detroit was, we use Detroit as an example of what would happen to the United States. They said that was a poor example. They both agreed that Glass-Steagall had to get it in. But you have to be very, what is it nice about getting it in? and I just blew off the stack. I just bellered out, you know, I've listened to enough, and I was about 1 inch my nose from his nose, telling him that I've listened to enough of his bullshit. It was time that he started to listening to what needed to be done for the good of the people in this crisis, you know. And I just about created a riot before I got done. And I think we have to do that all over the country, just as good and the best any of us can do.
Yeah, and this Wednesday, that's October 2nd, when Obama met with these people, Jamie Dimon, J.P. Morgan, Lloyd Blankfein, and Goldman Sachs, they had Senator Crapo from the West there, knowing that he's a flunky to prevent Glass-Steagall. They had a representative, Hans Arling, I think he's from Texas, likewise. I mean, this is nose to nose. This is eyeball to eyeball, nose to nose, just as you said, Ron, not just in South Dakota, but here. And we can do it. It's not a question of what are the odds or anything else. This is the showdown time.
It's just like my we've got two candidates in the state here. One is running for U.S. Senate on a Democratic ticket, and the other one on a Republican ticket. I told them, you know, and both of them have come out in support of Glass-Steagall. And I told them, now is the time to open your mouth. Rather than putting up signs and trying to win with popular opinion, why don't you guys go home and study and figure out what needs to be done for the good of the people, and then stand up and say, this is what needs to be done for the good of the people. Know within that space between your ears what the right thing is to do. Don't go out there and check popular opinion to do what needs to be done. I mean, this is no time to fool around. We need leaders now.
That's right, and popular opinion is prepared to eat. So I want to, Andy, there was one thing that Hector has asked in the past. There's only a few minutes. It's a bit unfair. But, Andy, you want to just summarize in particular that Wall Street, besides the gambling in Chicago, the control of processing, the driving of plantation agriculture and getting rid of family farmers and all this other, that they moved in against independent banks in the countryside by subverting institutions we had since the 30s for credit for farming. And that's another element of this octopus that has to be ended. Go ahead.
Well, Lynn has been very vocal about the strength of America is small-town independent banks, where the banker can visit with the borrower one-on-one. He can see his work, and he knows if he's a good credit risk and so forth. Well, back in the 80s, when there was Paul Volcker had jacked the interest rates up to 20% in that area, and it had just put tremendous pressure on the ag borrowers, and in come the bank examiners and told the farm credit system that Roosevelt had established that you got to go out and get some of these loans straightened around. And so it was a complete upheaval. And the farm credit system was, in a sense, it was bankrupted. And I kind of lost track of what went on. And when I was up at the legislature trying to get the Glass-Steagall resolution introduced in Minnesota, we were looking, these legislators were saying, well, where do the bankers say about this? So we contacted these small-town bankers, and what we were hearing from them, they were just really hostile toward what's now called AgStar, which is the spawn of the farm credit system. And Wall Street rescued them, and now the battering ram against the independent banks is a AgStar, which is now controlled by Wall Street, is funded by Wall Street. Not that it wasn't before, but they have top-down control now. And so they're lending money to agriculture and to farmers at a lower rate than the commercial banks can afford to do it. So what's happening is that the independent banks are getting squeezed. They're consolidating. We have owners, you know, independent owners that have about a dozen small-town banks, and we don't have that individual banker owning his bank anymore, or the the investors in the bank. So this is putting tremendous strain on agriculture credit, and we've got Rabobank, which is a Dutch bank that's out here funding large farmers, and you know there's an attack from all directions, and the AgStar credit is the farmers like them because they can get money cheaper there from the independent bankers, but they don't realize what the operation is being run against the institutions that are the foundation of America, and that's the small town bank. You know, the Wall Street banks, they don't produce anything. They're just parasites. They, as opposed to the banks out here that these small bankers that lend to for production. So maybe, Ron, you have something to say about went through the crisis in the 80s.
But quickly, I'd just like to say it right now, what's destroying agriculture out here is the lack of parity and this speculation-driven land real estate bubble that is rewarding people that are sitting on land. I mean, I never got paid all my years for what I produced in my work, but now I'm going to be turned into a millionaire because I was able to set on and hold on to a little bit of land. I mean, and they can wipe that away from me with the stroke of a pen, just like they did in 1984 when they devalued all the land in South Dakota and the assets of the farmers by 50% with a stroke of a pencil. And now we've got all our small-town community banks tied into this insanity. They're either tied into this high-priced land with mortgages, or they've had to go speculate with the Wall Street investment bankers to make a go. So when they drop the bottom out of this thing, I mean, our small bankers are gone. Our last productive farmers are going to be gone. And as Lynn says, this is a meltdown we're in, and we need a totally new system. And LaRouche, I mean, I don't know how this man can stand there all these years saying the same thing, and people can't pick up on and figure out what the hell needs to be done.
Well,
it's time to listen to Lynn LaRouche, as the president of Mexico once said.
Yeah, that's right. And that's, you said it, our time has come over even. I'm afraid we have to end it. The hours zip by. But I want to thank you, and I think that is the marching order. I want to ask everyone to please look on LaRouchePub.com, but look on LaRouchePAC.com and find this new statement that the moment of truth has arrived, and we are demanding that we meet and pass Glass-Steagall now. Shut down this Wall Street shutdown operation. Okay, so this is October 5th, 2013, and I thank everyone, Hector Rivas, Andy Olson, and Ron Wieczorek. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.